Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. Talk about the contribution of love to our well-being, and later in the talk to talk about the contribution of love in dealing with pain in our meditation. And this is to follow on something that Achan Brahm mentioned here last week, I think, but I know he mentioned it at the entry to the rains ceremony last Sunday. And that is a finding or something that's happened in America, where people who are sick and who have people who are praying for them are able to get reduced rates on their health insurance because they seem to do much better. They seem to recover more quickly and return to full health with better prospects for health than people who don't have others praying for them. And so I'd like to talk tonight about this interesting fact and give some evidence for why it is that that sort of thing could happen, that people who get prayed for recover more quickly. Because one of the interesting facts that is being substantiated through experiments and scientific discovery is that the capacity to give love and also to receive love has a profound effect on our health. And this is something which is central to the Buddha's teachings. So we have to first of all know what we mean when we're talking about love. And in the studies that I'm going to share with you tonight, we're not talking just about passionate love, erotic love, the kind of love that we see in all the movies and magazines and television shows, which is very often to do with one-to-one exclusive love, possession and passion. And there's a lot more to love than just that. Obviously there is the love between partners, but there's also the love between parents and children, and between children and their parents, and between friends, between people that you have an affinity for. And in the Buddha's teaching, we are trying to move from a self-centered kind of love that is given on condition that we get something back from the person that we're giving it to, and also given on condition that that person is the way that I want them to be, and also the exclusivity, which only gives love to a small group of people, the ones we like, the ones who support us. In Buddhism, we're trying to move away from that narrow understanding of love to a kind of love which is universal, which we can give to everyone, regardless of whether we even like them, but because we have that love to share, and because they need it. We all need love. So that's what we're trying to work towards in Buddhism. And sometimes people have the understanding that Buddhism is about not having love. And especially when they see monks and nuns, they think that because we've left the household life and we've given up exclusive partnerships, that we're actually turning our back on love. But in fact, that's completely opposite to the whole aim of this practice, and the reason why celibacy is such an important aspect of monastic life. Because what we're trying to do is to move away from the exclusive partnership kind of love, to I just love this person, or this group of people, these are the people that are my family, these are the people who belong to me. In monastic life, and the reason why celibacy is such an essential part of it, is that we're actually trying to put it into practice to move to this universal love. And one of the things that the Buddha said is that we need to be able to see all men as our brothers or as our fathers, and all women as our sisters or as our mothers. And I like this. I like to be called Sister Vayama, because it always reminds me of the relationship that I'm trying to encourage in my own heart, that's the relationship that I have with the person that I'm speaking to. Doesn't matter whether I'm just meeting them for the first time. So in Buddhism, we certainly aren't about cold-heartedness and turning our back on the world. We're about opening up to the widest possible world, not only human beings, but all beings everywhere. And this is what the evidence is showing through investigation on the impact and effect of love, loving relationships, on our physical health. And this is being investigated in a way which is not just airy-fairy, but which is actually showing in a scientific way that can be reproduced the consequences on the physiological functioning of the body when people are in loving relationships. And I think it's important to understand we're talking about relationships, a two-way street. We're not talking just about getting, but also in giving. And I'll talk a little bit about how that's been proven also to have a beneficial effect on people. But first of all, I'd like to talk about some of the studies which are to do with people in partnerships, in relationships. And one study was done with over 400 women. And these women were asked about the quality of their relationship with their husband. And they were asked basically about whether that relationship was supportive to them or not. And then they were examined to look at the relationship between the response that they gave and the quality of their immune system. Now, the immune system, as probably all of you are aware, is that defence system in the body which protects us from infection, protects us from invasion by harmful entities, bacteria and viruses and all those sorts of things, and also helps us to cope with other things like toxins in the environment, things that have to be processed and dealt with so that the body doesn't become sick. And if the immune system is working well, when something comes into the body which is a threat, then that is dealt with very quickly, and it minimises the strain that the rest of the body feels in having to deal with that thing, the impact of that invasion. And you can imagine that if you are able to deal with these stresses and impacts quite well, then you're able to live a fairly normal life and able to recover fairly quickly when these infections or whatever come into your body. If your immune system isn't working well, then it's very difficult to protect the body against illness and also to recover quickly and therefore to maintain a normal lifestyle. So in this investigation, the investigators examined the occurrence of natural killer cells in the immune system of the subjects of this study. And the natural killer cells are the T cells, the ones that are the first line of defence against invading organisms or bacteria. And what they found was that the women who reported that they had a supportive relationship with their spouse had a much more healthy immune system, a much more competent immune system, measured by the increase or the greater a number of these natural killer cells in their immune system compared to the women who didn't have supportive relationships with their spouse, reported by the women themselves. So that's one study. And just to so you know that it's not just all the men who have to give the support, another study in Israel this time, with over 10,000 men over a 5-year period. And these 10,000 men were all 40 years plus. And they were all examined to see what was their potential or likelihood to develop angina. And angina is a condition to do with the heart, the functioning of the heart, narrowing of the blood vessels leading to the heart. And it's a very painful condition when it develops, and it predisposes you to further problems with the heart, heart attack and that sort of thing. So these 10,000 men were examined. They were examined for their cholesterol level, their blood pressure, their anxiety level. They were all given electrocardiographs, and they were also given a questionnaire on their family and psychosocial aspects of their life. That is, what kind of family life they had, what sort of connections they had in the community, and any problems there. And one of the questions that they were asked was, does your wife show her love to you? And as the study was concluded, they found that the best way of predicting whether someone was likely to develop angina was that question. If the person reported that their wife showed their love for them, even if they had were at high risk of developing angina because of the other factors like cholesterol level, and blood pressure, and the reading of their ECG, for example, and even anxiety levels in their daily life, they had a much reduced risk of developing angina if they had reported that their wife showed their love for them. Even people who had high risk, if they had that supportive relationship which seemed to act as a buffer against the stresses and the pressures of life, then they had a lower incidence of angina. Now, it's not only relationships with those who are close to us, partners, people who are in our intimate circle. Many studies have been done with pets and the effect of animals on people's well-being and their recovery, for example, from heart attacks. It's been found that that when people are in an environment where they have a pet around, or even when pets have been introduced into institutions and people have the opportunity to receive the unconditional love that doggies give or that cats give. They don't care who you are or what you've been doing or whether you're miserable. They'll still come up and be nice to you. And not only that they're nice to you, but those animals give the person the opportunity to show love, to give a cuddle, to pat the dog on the head, to talk in silly language, ask the dog how they are, all that sort of thing, which is an expression of care and concern. And this opportunity to give love and receive love is what is crucial. And not only with animals, even studies that have been done using plants, where plants have been introduced into aged persons' hostels, for example, or into the rooms of people who are recovering from illness, they find that it has a dramatic effect on the well-being of the people who are involved. And just one more example of this was a very interesting study that was done where a group of people, mixed ages, mixed genders, mixed backgrounds, were shown a video of Mother Teresa at work in Calcutta, in the slums of Calcutta, tending to the sick and the dying. And having watched that video, they were examined to see again the quality of their immune system. And though this was a mixed group, every person, after they had watched that video, showed a significant and immediate increase in one of the very important components of the immune system, immunoglobulin A, for those of you who might have a medical background. There was a dramatic and significant and immediate increase in that component of the immune system in the people who had just watched this video. Now you might say, well, how can that happen, just watching it? They weren't even there. They weren't asked to give money. They weren't even participating. They were just passively watching. But just being exposed to an example of that sort of altruistic love, which we in Buddhism would call metta, loving kindness, and karuna, compassion, that had an effect on the well-being of the people who were watching. And so this has a very, I think, a very powerful message for us, because we can see how we are affected by what we see around us and how important it is that we have role models, we have examples of people who are showing that kind of love in this world. Now, did the people feel Mother Teresa's love just by watching the video? My explanation would be that being exposed to that kind of behaviour actually put the people in touch with that capacity within themselves. That opened up the altruistic love that they had within their own heart. They were only opened up to that potential through coming in contact with something that triggered it. It was in there, but it needed something to trigger it off. And having been triggered off, it was for their own benefit. So these studies, I think, are very important for us to reflect on, because they have a measurable component or a measurable aspect of our physical well-being that we're able to see is affected by being able to express and to receive love. One of the things which I noticed very much when I first went up to the nuns' monastery was how much I was waiting for things to be there that I could interact with. When I first moved up there, the land was had been vacant for many years, and even the animals were very wary, and they didn't come around, not like at the monastery at Serpentine. They were very timid, and every day I would put out the scraps from my food and nobody was interested in it. No animal would come. And I was always very disappointed, because I wanted to engage in a relationship. I wanted to make a connection with the other beings that were living there. And I was so happy the first summer that at least the butterflies would come and suck on the mango seeds. And that was all I could encourage to come out. And now I've been there for a year and a half or so, and I have a number of animals that come. And of course, the interesting thing is that I need the animals. They don't need me. They've been surviving there without human beings for a long time. But it certainly is a support for my heart that I'm able to feed them. And there are mice and rats that come and feed. And then there are magpies that come around. And those of you who come up to the monastery will know that the magpies keep a watch on the clock, and they know when people are due to arrive, and they sing a song when people come, because they're happy that the food's arriving. And I feed them. Sometimes they're not even interested in the food, but they come around anyway, which is a delight for me. And the other thing I do is that I always put food out for the mice who come around our dana shed, because they started originally to come into the dana shed at night and eat the mats that we have there. And so I couldn't keep them out, and I decided the way of dealing with that was to put food out for them. And so now they come and eat the food and they don't eat the mats. They still come in and make a mess, but at least they don't eat the mats. But recently, after all the rain, not only the rats and the mice are coming, but the millipedes are coming. I don't know whether you've got them in your garden, but after a rain there are lots of these many-legged creatures walking around, especially at night time they come out. And it's very interesting, because we think that things like millipedes must be really dumb, you know, millipede, where's their brain, what do they do? And it's interesting, what use are they? Of course, no one asks what use are we humans, but what use are the millipedes? But it's interesting because they know where the food is. It's in the same spot every night. And so every night now the millipedes come to eat the food that I've put for the mice. And I just get so much delight out of seeing all these little fellows crawling around and eating the food. They eat the funniest things. I mean, how they even manage to do it with their little jaws, I don't know. But it's a great joy for me. And I could see, again, as I said, that the animals didn't need me. They were all surviving very well. And none of the kangaroos or any of the echidna and all those fellows, they're not at all interested. But at least all these other little creatures come, and I do enjoy it so much. And I can see the truth of this, that when we have the capacity and the opportunity to offer what we have, to share what we have, it's for our own benefit, before it even is a benefit for the other person. And the Buddha, when he talked about the importance of loving kindness, he said that it's better to have loving kindness in your heart. It's more beneficial for you to have loving kindness in your heart for as long as it takes to milk a cow than it is to be able to give gold coins 3 times a day to someone who needs it. Because it's the love in our heart that is the thing which drives us to act in ways which are beneficial for others and also which are beneficial for ourselves. And so this is a very important thing to remember, that when we give and when we give love, first of all, we're giving to ourselves. Now, this is all leading up to how we're going to cope with pain in our life and pain in our meditation, using love as one of the supporting conditions. And first of all, I'd like to make it clear that when we talk about pain, the Buddha didn't say that pain is all in the mind. There's no such thing as pain, because sometimes people misinterpret the Buddha's teaching and they think that there's no such thing as physical pain, for example. And if only they could get their mind right, then the pain would disappear. But that's not the Buddha's teaching. The first aspect of dukkha, of the unsatisfactoriness of life, is dukkha dukkata. And that includes the ordinary physical and mental pain that we experience as a result of having this human mind and body. The Buddha talked about the unsatisfactoriness of life because old age, sickness, death and birth are all suffering. And what's suffering about old age, for example, is the aches and pains come. The energy goes. Can't do as much as we used to. Can't do it as quickly. And we don't even care sometimes. That's part of what happens with getting older and slower and all that sort of thing. But there's a lot of physical discomfort as a consequence of getting older. There's also the suffering, the Buddha said, of being in contact with what we don't like. The grey hairs, the fading complexion, the fading energy, all of that which we don't like. Losing what we'd like to keep, our figure, our attractiveness, all that kind of thing. Sometimes people don't like the fact that because they're older, no one's really interested in their opinion anymore. What would they know? That kind of thing. So these are all aspects of suffering, but particularly physical suffering. Now, once we understand that pain does exist, it's not something that is all in the mind, the next thing we need to know about the way that the Buddha taught is that he taught that the ordinary worldling, the ordinary person who hasn't really understood the teaching to the depths of the teaching, suffers or is afflicted by two darts. Whereas the Aryan, the noble person, that is the one who has seen the truth of life for themselves, they are only afflicted by one dart. And that one dart is the physical discomfort, the unpleasant feeling of the body, which we call pain. The Buddha felt pain. The Buddha had discomfort. And towards the end of his life, he described his body as being like an old cart that was ready to fall apart, and it was just held together with twine. And he said that the only time he had comfort in the body was when he was in deep meditation, when he could leave the body behind. So he certainly did experience physical pain, like all of us. But what he didn't experience was the mental anguish accompanying that physical pain. And this is the second dart that we all experience. When the body starts to pack up, or when we have an acute illness, when something goes wrong, there's not only the physical discomfort, but there's the mental dislike of this thing that's happening. There's very often a turning away from it, thinking that it's a mistake, thinking that it's a problem. Why did this have to happen to me? This shouldn't happen to me. Maybe there's fear about, what does this mean? Is it going to get worse? Am I going to die? If we're suffering from chronic pain, there may be depression when it arises again. Oh, I thought I was free of this, and here it is again. Or maybe there's the knowledge that we're stuck with it, that it's not going to get better, and we're going to have to bear with it for the rest of this life. So this is the second dart which we suffer from, and that's the dart which we can do something about. Our mental attitude to the unpleasant discomfort that we feel in this body, which we call pain. And the way that we relate to our pain is again not just the pain itself, but our mental attitude. And another study, just to show that it's not just made up, that mental attitude does have an effect on pain and how we perceive pain and cope with it. In another study that was done in a hospital with patients who had all had the same operation and who were matched according to age and previous health and all those sorts of things, an experiment was done where half of the patients were put into a ward that looked out onto the gardens of the hospital, looked out onto trees and greenery. And the other half of the patients were put into a ward that looked out onto the roof and the brick walls of the next building. And what they were investigating was how this affected people's ability to cope with their pain. And the measure that they used was the number of requests from each patient for pain relief medication. And what they discovered was that the people who were in the beds that looked out onto the gardens had a drastic reduction in the number of requests for pain relief compared to the people who were in the beds that looked out on the bricks, the walls and the roofs. They'd all had the same operation. Obviously, they all were in discomfort, but there was something about being able to look out onto the bush or onto the garden that helped people to cope with their pain. So this is a very a clear indication of the mental component in relating to our pain, in coming to terms with our pain, in dealing with the physical discomfort of the pain that we're carrying. And this is what I particularly want to address now when we think about how we deal with pain in meditation. Because whether the pain is acute and arising just because we're sitting in meditation, or is chronic pain that we're carrying with us in our daily life, obviously our mental attitude is going to have an impact on how well we can deal with that pain. In meditation, it's very normal that we experience physical discomfort, because we're sitting in a way that we usually don't sit for long periods of time, sitting on the floor, sitting cross-legged. Even if we're sitting in a chair, even if we're lying down, if we meditate for long enough, physical discomfort will arise. Very often when we sit down to meditate, it's not only because of the position that we're sitting in, it's because in meditation we are, if you like, allowing old physical pains and old unfinished emotional business to arise in the mind. In meditation, we're very often giving permission for things to come into our conscious awareness, which in daily life we try to stuff down, we try to ignore, which we don't have the time or the energy or even the awareness to deal with. And particularly as we start to calm the mind and clear out some of the surface debris from the mind, the busyness of the mind, very often old unfinished business will arise. And it will arise not just as thinking, not just as emotions, but as physical manifestations in the body, aches and pains. And the way that we can tell whether this is what's arising for us is that usually they are there when we meditate, but when we get up for meditation, they've gone. Maybe a terrible ache in the shoulder, or a pain in the neck, or a hurt in the leg. And we wonder where it's come from. We can't stand it. And when we get up from our meditation, it disappears. And we forget about it until we sit down the next time, and there it is again. So this is often an indication that old stuff is trying to raise its head and say, hey, remember me? Remember this old hurt, maybe an old injury, physical injury, long forgotten, or maybe an old emotional hurt that we never quite finished off and which we stuffed down in our consciousness and which we held in our body and which is now presenting itself because we've given it enough space. What happens very often, people think, oh, this meditation is terrible. All it does is make me ache. All it does is make me upset. I'm not going to do it anymore. Something must be wrong. And if we have that understanding, then very often we'll stop meditating. So we have to realize that this isn't a mistake. This is actually something that's good that's happening. This is a purification. But how we are able to make the best use of the opportunity that's presenting itself for purification is that we have to be able to open to what is there, to what is presenting itself. And if you think about pain, physical pain, emotional pain, generally, because it's something that we don't like, we try to turn our back on it. We try to push it away. We try to get away from it. And of course, when we're sitting in meditation, we can't get away because we're stuck in a stable position. So very often the mind will try to run away through fantasy or falling asleep or just refusing, tightening up. All of those things are ways that we turn our back on what is presenting itself. And so what we need to do, in fact, is to open to it with love. This is the opposite to what we usually do to what we don't like. And this is where our daily life practice helps us, because if we've been practicing in daily life to give and to receive love and to extend that love not only to the people that are close to us, not only to the people we care about, not only to the people whom we like, but to whomever we come in contact with, whoever needs it, then we're already practicing to be able to open up with that same quality of love to whatever it is that's presenting itself in our meditation that we don't like. A very fundamental support for doing it in meditation is to do it in daily life. To do it in meditation helps us to do it in daily life. So this is a very important understanding that there's this reciprocal relationship between daily life practice and meditation practice. So the first thing is to open up to something that we don't like to have there. And if we can turn our attention, first of all, to the pain, when we don't like something, we cut it off. We try to pretend it's not there. We even dissociate it from ourselves. So the leg that's aching or the back that's aching, we sort of try to pretend that it's not really part of this whole body. And so we have to now open up the boundaries or the barriers between that part, that offending part, and the rest of us. And we do that by appreciating how it is an essential part of what makes up this whole body. So first of all, just the mental turning towards that thing and switching from aversion to loving kindness, to acceptance, even if it's only tolerance at the beginning. And then to use loving kindness deliberately to incorporate that part of the body which we've been trying to cut off, which we've been trying to ignore. And so to actively send loving kindness to that part of the body. And just as when we try to do loving kindness towards people, it's difficult to do loving kindness towards people who irritate us or who've hurt us from the beginning to do it like that. What we do is we start first of all by giving loving kindness to people that are easy to love, that we can easily have feelings of concern and tenderness towards. And then as we get that kind of feeling going in our heart, then we gradually extend it to the person who's our enemy or the person who's hurt us. So it's the same when we're turning towards the body. We may find it very difficult to just turn towards that part of the body or that place in the body where there is great discomfort. So we have to prepare the mind by first of all going to the body as a whole, or parts of the body that we like, parts of the body that we can appreciate, parts of the body that look good, parts of the body that work well, parts of the body that we value. And we extend our appreciation to those parts. We visualize them, we put our attention on them, we reflect on what they give to us in our life. These wonderful hands which allow us to scratch our nose, which allow us to reach out for something we want, which allow us to write letters to people we care about. These wonderful hands and how much work they do every day. And that's the sort of feeling that we generate towards our hands, and we work through the body until we come to that part that's really giving us trouble. And that part, my goodness me, it's also playing its role in the functioning of this body. Whether it's an internal organ or whether it's one of our limbs, whether it's our back, we can think of all the things that that part of the body does for us. Holds us up straight if it's the back. All the other bits hang off it. All those inside bits are hanging off this spinal column. It's amazing, and it's been doing it since we've been walking upright. So it's wonderful. So we look for those things that we can appreciate, and then we actively generate those feelings of appreciation towards that part of the body. Now, if we have chronic pain, that is pain that doesn't go away once we get up from meditation, if it's something that we're dealing with all day in our daily life or in episodes which may last for days or weeks, then we particularly have to generate this feeling of loving kindness and acceptance and opening to that part of the body which is giving us trouble.